Welcome to the October 2014 issue of Dialogues in Dermatology. The American Academy of Dermatology is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The American Academy of Dermatology designates this enduring material for a maximum of 2 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should claim only the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. This activity is recognized by the American Academy of Dermatology for 2 AAD recognized credits and may be used toward the AAD CME award. Participation in this activity is completed by listening to dialogues on CD or a downloaded MP3 file, achievement of a 70% or higher score on the post-test, and completion of an activity evaluation. The date of original release for this issue is October 2014. The expiration date is September 2017. At the conclusion of this learning activity, participants should be able to identify treatment methods for managing patients affected by common arthropod bites. Identify commonly used alternative therapies and botanical products in treatment of dermatologic conditions. Identify the appropriate first laboratory test to diagnose syphilis. And differentiate between benzathine penicillin G, bicillin LA, and benzathine procaine penicillin, bicillin CR, and identify which one is appropriate in the treatment of syphilis. Contributors to this issue of Dialogues in Dermatology have disclosed the following financial relationships. Dr. Stuart Brown has been a stockholder for and received stock from Johnson & Johnson Consumer Products Company and Pfizer, Inc. Dr. Daniel M. Siegel has been a principal investigator for and received grants and research funding from Amgen. He has served on the board of directors and received stock options from Caliber Imaging and Diagnostics, Inc. He has been the founder of and received patent royalties or other compensation for intellectual property rights from Dantech Systems. Dr. Daniel M. Siegel has been a principal investigator for and received grants and research funding from Amgen. He has served on the board of directors and received stock options from Caliber Imaging and Diagnostics, Inc. He has been the founder of and received patent royalties or other compensation for intellectual property rights from Dantech Systems. He has served on the advisory board for and received honoraria from DUSA Pharmaceuticals, Inc., Galderma Laboratories, LP, Genentech, Inc., Elio Pharma US, and MIM Labs. He has served as a consultant for and received honoraria from DUSA Pharmaceuticals, Inc., Leering Swan, Elio Pharma US, Makucell, Inc., Meta Pharmaceuticals, Inc., and Melasciences. He has received, served, and received patent royalties or other compensation for intellectual property rights from Elsevier, Inc. He has been a speaker for and received honoraria from Genentech, Inc. and Elio Pharma US. He has been a consultant for and received stock options from Logical Images. And he has served on the advisory board for and received grants and research funding from Michelson Diagnostics Limited. He has been the principal investigator for and received equipment from Michelson Diagnostics Limited, served on the advisory board and received stock options from Modernizing Medicine, Quinova Pharmaceuticals, Inc., Remote Derm, Surgical Media, Inc., and he has served on the advisory board and received stock from Photomedics. He has a relationship with Sonova Work and received honoraria. He has served on the advisory board and received other financial benefit from Surgical Media, Inc. He has been a consultant for and received fees from Valiant Pharmaceuticals International, and he has served on the advisory board and received no compensation from Vivicare. Dr. Kenneth Katz has been a stockholder and received no compensation from Arrowhead Research Corporation, pending, and Cinta Pharmaceuticals Corporation. All other contributors, including editors, interviewees, reviewers, and staff, reported they have no relevant relationships with commercial interests. A comprehensive list of disclosed financial relationships is available in the syllabus.
Welcome back to Dialogues in Dermatology. This is Terry Cronin, your editor-in-chief. This is Dialogues in Dermatology for October 2014, Volume 70, Issue 10. I hope you're enjoying October and looking forward to Halloween. In this edition, we tried to scare up some interesting subjects that are sure to both frighten and astound you. We'll be talking about dangerous insects and how to recognize and treat infestations. We have a veritable witch's brew of botanicals and natural remedies to learn about. And finally, we have a dialogue regarding what many believe to be modern dermatologists' oldest enemy, Voldemort. Just kidding. In all seriousness, we'll be talking about syphilis. An arthropod is an invertebrate animal, having an exoskeleton, a segmented body, and jointed appendages. Arthropods include the insects, arachnids, and crustaceans. Whether dermatologists are dealing with the signs and symptoms of insect or spider bites, or downright infestations with bed bugs or scabies, the study of these bugs allows us to greater serve our patients and alleviate their suffering. In this dialogue, we join Dr. Dirk M. Elston and Dr. Stuart Brown, who thankfully give us their insights on how to deal with bad arthropods.
Hello, this is Stuart Brown, and I am very fortunate today to be visiting with a past president of the American Academy of Dermatology, who is a master of all dermatologic trades. I'm fortunate to be here today with Dr. Dirk M. Elston. Dirk is director of the Ackerman Academy of Dermatopathology in New York City, and in addition has many clinical titles, one of them being clinical professor of dermatology at Robert Wood Johnson School of Medicine in New Jersey, and several other in the osteopathic world. Dirk has been writing the column in Cutis for a number of years on bugs and parasitic disorders. So we're going to discuss that today. In general, Dirk, and I know they're the largest population in the world, are insects and their cousins. What bugs are of particular interest in dermatology now?
Well, you mentioned that they're the largest population in the world, and indeed they are. The arthropods outnumber us a lot. The ones, of course, that affect our patients most are scabies, lice. In the South, chiggers are a huge problem. And then fleas and bedbugs absolutely everywhere. And zoonotic mites are from everywhere, from onions to cheese and flour, so we encounter them everywhere.
I understand they're becoming more difficult to manage. Is that true?
Well, resistance among the arthropods that we commonly see was first reported among lice. And in Southwest Asia, knockdown resistance was reported initially. It's not a complete resistance to killing, but it takes much longer exposures, longer and longer exposures in order for the organism to die. And the way you see that initially, when exposed to a pyrethrin or pyrethroid, the louse traditionally would be rapidly immobilized. It would appear dead, but wasn't really dead, just immobilized. That's called knockdown. The lice would become resistant to that initial knockdown, and that's a good marker for resistance to killing by the pyrethroids. And that's widespread now. It's all over the world. We have a lot of it in the United States. We have monoamine oxidase resistance among pyrethrins. That you can overcome with piperonyl butoxide, and we've had to do that for years. And now there's esterase-mediated malathion resistance. So we have widespread resistance to a lot of the agents that we use to treat lice. Among other arthropods, we're even seeing resistance to some of the brand new agents like spinosad. One that resistance has not yet emerged to is benzyl alcohol. And so the benzyl alcohol products that use inert ingredients to asphyxiate the lice, and the benzyl alcohol simply stuns open the respiratory spherical to allow it to be occluded. Those currently show no evidence of resistance.
Is ivermectin showing any resistance?
Absolutely. Ivermectin resistance first emerged among zoonotic lice. We see it in the human louse population and also in scabies, where there's resistance to lindane, permethrin, ivermectin. Not yet to sulfur. So precipitated sulfur, you can use 6 to 10%. I usually use 10% in white petrolatum. Remains your most reliable agent for the treatment of scabies.
So the oldest of all the treatments is still
the oldest,
the
and
most
it's still
consistent.
It's still how most of the world treats scabies. They use benzoate and they use precipitated sulfur.
That's interesting. It shows that not just the wee little beasties known as bacteria have resistance developed, but even the more complex animals, such as the bugs, and as Wally Wilson used to call them, the lugs, the bugs, and the thugs. How often is crusted scabies missed? Regularly. And that's the one that has the thousands of organisms as compared to the usual one, six or eight.
Very, very commonly. And that's, you know, missing crusted scabies carries its own punishment because those involved frequently become infested, as does the remainder of the ward, the nurses, the other patients. So it's one you really don't want to miss. We were always taught that syphilis was the great masquerader, but so is scabies. In the older patients in immunosuppressed population, often there's silvery scale on the ears, on the acral surfaces, hyperkeratosis under the nails, resembling psoriatic hyperkeratosis. Those are clues to crusted scabies. But remember, in your older patient population, they can present with very few visible lesions. Generalized pruritus, a few excoriations, they often don't manifest the same degree of immune response that other patients would, and so their cutaneous lesions are less visible.
Your co-author, Tim Berger, finds it fascinating dealing with pruritic older people. He calls them immune senescence, and I think it's a wonderful term because as our immunity tends to wane, then we do get pruritus, and it, according to Tim, it is so often an occult scabies.
That's absolutely true. And to some extent, it may be immune senescence, and to other extent, just immune tolerance, that over time we develop tolerance to many, many antigens, and scabies among them. The other thing that we see, of course, is in both the old population and the young population that scabies can masquerade as some other very serious conditions. In children, scabies can manifest as Langerhans cell histiocytosis and masquerade as that. And there are quite a few children who have been treated with alkylating agents for a diagnosis of Langerhans cell histiocytosis, only to be found later that it's scabies, which can give a very dense dermal infiltrate of Langerhans cells. That's a horrible thing to have to explain to the parents, that the child has now been treated with an agent that has a risk of leukemia down the road. Speaking of leukemic risk, everyone should know there is some epidemiologic data suggesting that permethrin may have a leukemic association. And that's based on a mother who had arachnophobia, who was massively abusing pyrethroids while pregnant, and the child was born with congenital leukemia and a translocation that the permethrin could reproduce in vitro. Also, some epidemiologic data that treatment for lice with an insecticidal shampoo is linked to a higher risk of leukemia. So as we have better agents, such as benzyl alcohol, to use, it may be good, especially when resistance is prevalent. Why would you use something that has some theoretical use, has a lot of resistance when other agents are available? One of the other things that scabies can masquerade as is pemphigoid, including not only bully filled with eosinophils, which isn't that surprising for an arthropod to recruit eosinophils, but positive immunofluorescence. And who gets pemphigoid? Often older patients in nursing homes. Who gets scabies? Older patients in nursing homes. And just keeping in the back of your mind that the positive immunofluorescence can be related to the scabies. Also think back to that older patient who just itches. One of the things we do is we'll get a direct immunofluorescence because sometimes it's subclinical immunobullous disease that's driving the itch. The positive IF can sometimes be scabies as well.
Yes, it is oftentimes the great masquerader, and it is not letting go.
There's no shortage of scabies now, and I think along with bed bugs and other things, part of it is just global travel has become so much more common.
Now, so many newspapers begin with the talking of you're bringing it home in your luggage. And is bedbugs more terror or is it real?
Well, it's a combination of the two, of course. No one likes the idea of bringing bedbugs into their home, especially when they're very difficult to kill. Resistance is widespread among the bedbugs, and there are a variety of ways that you can still kill them, including hyperthermia, where you have to bring the entire apartment or house up to a certain temperature. These things are fairly difficult to accomplish, and they're expensive, so you would rather not bring them home. And it's not just your luggage. In the movie theater, putting your purse on the ground, the bedbugs are very happy to enter into
the dark.
Exactly. So we see it. We see it increasingly. People don't think of it in their own homes. And you have to be attuned to some of the signs. Andrea Zenglein at Hershey described the eyelid sign in children. Looks very much like the Romagna's sign that we learned of with trypanosome infections and the bite of the reduvid. But the bedbugs will do the same thing. And a child with unilateral eyelid swelling, you should think of bedbug infestation in the home. Adults with what looks like classic prurigo nodularis on the arms. You uniboot the arms, they get better. You take the uniboots off, they get worse. Not just because they're picking. What they're picking is fresh bedbug bites. And the clue there can be histology, where you see endothelial swelling, wedge-shaped infiltrate, perivascular eosinophils. Those are all clues that what's being picked is a bite giving rise to the prurigo.
There's a relatively inexpensive test that one can do at home. It requires dry ice, which is presently hard to find unless you have access to a good proper ice cream parlor. And the bed bug is drawn by carbon dioxide. So you can make a little, not ladder, but slope for the bed bug to crawl up, falls into like a cat dish with dry ice in it, and then can't get out of the slick sides, and you have proof for it other than the breakfast, lunch, and dinner lesions.
Many of the arthropods are attracted both by temperature and by carbon dioxide, and that sort of thing has been used. They also have dogs that are very good at sniffing out bed bugs that many of the exterminators will use to detect bed bug infestation in the home.
Do they daylight as FBI agents?
It's a good question. We have had patients in the clinic who've had the bed bugs crawl out of their sleeve onto the desktop while they're in the clinic with us. Causes no end of panic among the nursing staff. Does give you the correct diagnosis, though.
They're rather small, but certainly easily visible, unlike chiggers, because chiggers in Texas we call red bugs. But you can, with some magnification, see them. But bed bugs don't need it. They're about a quarter of an inch and they're compressed flat.
Correct. The bed bugs are about the size of a small tick in size. And they're reddish brown and easily identified if found.
Over the years, we've all had patients come to us saying, and panicked, saying, I got bit by a spider. And of course, they have an itchy lesion or something of that nature, and there's no hole in their skin or anything like that. Probably I've had 1,000 and I've seen 2. There is some concerted hysteria about this one condition, but the brown spider bite is, first of all, painless, unlike the black widow. And so if they say, I remember being bitten, then I know that the odds are against it. But what is your experience so far with brown recluse? The original papers on it were by the group in Little Rock.
That area of the country, Arkansas and the adjoining states, have more brown recluse spiders than most other states, but they are widespread. The name recluse is there for a reason. They're a reclusive spider. They're not an aggressive spider. So there are the Tegenaria spiders in the Northwest that are a more aggressive spider. There are more aggressive hunting spiders that will bite, and those bites occasionally have dermonecrotic reactions. Brown recluse, occasionally you will see quite severe reactions. They can cause large vessel vasculitis and thrombosis that resembles polyarteritis nodosa histologically and can give real necrosis. So it does happen.
But that's localized as well as systemic effects from that.
Correct. And one of the concerns that's been raised over the years is whether prevention of the necrosis could worsen the systemic absorption. And our group actually did some studies on that while I was in Texas, and fortunately did not find evidence of worsening of the hematologic parameters when we used agents to prevent the necrosis. The big problem with preventing the necrosis is the lag time. Dapsone, colchicine, agents of that sort work very well if you're on them before you get bitten. The problem is, with any reasonable lag time to get the medication, it's too late by and large. The one that has worked, and I'll give you an anecdotal evidence of one patient. There's a patient who was shared with me by another dermatologist who described the initial bite, and he had the spider to examine, so he knew it actually was brown recluse. There was severe necrosis, and he injected around the periphery of the necrosis with triamcinolone. The venom spreads via gravity, and the patient went on to a severe necrotic ulcer, completely spared area that was injected, and then severe necrosis underneath the area that was injected as the venom spread. It's pretty good anecdotal evidence of one, that triamcinolone may have some benefit. So if I were to choose one thing, that's what I would choose, is local infiltration with triamcinolone.
Local infiltration, or would you put them on a good massive oral dose of them?
So that's been tried as well with lesser results. So oral prednisone probably inferior, based on limited data, to the local infiltration. But getting back to your original question, how many of them really are brown recluse bites when you see them? Well, in Austin, the years I was in Texas, we had a house that was infested with over 100,000 brown recluse spiders. When the proper fumigation was done and they were counted, the number was that high, and that sort of infestation does occur with the spiders. In that house, there was not a single bite of any of the family members because of the reclusive nature of the bite. Now, let's compare that to the state of Florida. There are about 120 brown recluse bites reported every year in Florida. There's only ever been one brown recluse spider identified in the state. So there are two possibilities. Either people overestimate the number of brown recluse bites, or there only is one spider, and boy, does it bite, because you see them out there. The other things that masquerade, of course, are pyoderma gangrenosum, which is very important for us to identify, and also MRSA abscesses. So the dermatologist plays a very important role in sorting out that confusion.
Dirk, could you care to summarize this?
So some of the key take-home points. Resistance is increasing, and the manifestations of infestation can be very protean. So good detective work, consider scabies, consider things in the differential that may look like scabies but really aren't scabies. And when treating, consider precipitated sulfur for patients resistant to scabies. Consider the benzyl alcohol product for lice that are resistant to treatment. And in the case of the brown recluse bites, when you do have someone where you really think it is a brown recluse bite and there's a severe dermonecrotic reaction, in addition to watching them for hemolytic anemia, infiltration with local triamcinolone, and I would use about 5 milligram per cc, or if you're doing a wide area, 2.5. That's something dermatologists are very comfortable with, and I think that's a reasonable intervention for those patients.
Dirk, I've known you a long time, and it's one of my constant pleasures is to do a dialogue with you. You are an absolute fount of information. Thank you. I speak for our listeners as well.
Thanks, Stu.
Arthropods are everywhere and tremendously outnumber humans in all parts of the world. Those most commonly encountered by the dermatologist include scabies, lice, chiggers, fleas, and bedbugs. Fortunately, a variety of therapeutic options are available to the clinician to treat patients affected by these pets. In regards to lice, resistance to traditional agents such as pyrethrin, malathione, and ivermectin is increasing. Luckily, to date, resistance has not emerged to benzyl alcohol. Similar resistance patterns are seen with scabies. There have been reports of resistance to lindane, permethrin, and ivermectin. Precipitated sulfur remains a viable option for these infestations. Scabies should always be considered in the differential diagnosis for any patient who presents with new onset pruritus. The clinical and histologic presentation can be variable, and the disease can masquerade as a number of entities from Langerhans cell histiocytosis to bullous pemphigoid. Bedbugs have received considerable media attention over the past few years, given the increased frequency of infestations. Diagnosis of these pests can be challenging. In addition to the breakfast, lunch, dinner sign present on physical examination, specially trained dogs are being used to help identify bedbugs. While not currently available, new technologies relying on DNA analysis are being evaluated to aid in the diagnostic challenge of bedbugs. Like scabies and lice, resistance is also widespread among bedbugs. One of the most effective treatment methods includes hyperthermia, which involves heating the patient's entire home to eradicate the bedbugs. Unfortunately, this treatment can be cost prohibitive to many patients.